We're this sharp tool. Use us. The afternoon of the scheduled meeting, he sat at his desk, staring at the Zoom screen. Priscilla was in another box. A few other BioHub people were there, too. There was only one box with a state official in it. Charity Dean was her name. But her box was dark. After several awkward minutes, when it became clear that Gally wasn't going to show up, she finally turned on her camera and unmuted herself. 11. Plastic Flowers. One of the odd things about American government, circa April 2020, was just how different appearances on the outside could be from the understanding on the inside. Inside California state government, inside even the Trump administration, there was some logic to everything that happened. Anyone on the inside could tell a more or less coherent story about whatever they had done and why. An innocent outsider who turned up and looked at what they had done, however, could be utterly baffled. Paul Markovich was such an outsider. Markovich was the CEO of Blue Shield of California, the health insurer to 4 million people with a network of 60,000 doctors. Seeing at the end of March that California ranked last in the nation in the percentage of its residents being tested for COVID, he'd pressed the state to do better, only to be asked by the governor to chair a task force to fix the problem. Gavin Newsom assigned two others to work on it, the venture capitalist Bob Kocher and Charity Dean. Markovich knew Kocher, but had never heard of Charity, and called around to find out what he could about her. In early April, the task force set a goal of testing 60,000 Californians a day by the end of August. They reached that number at the end of May, and by late June had doubled it. In 3 months, California went from roughly last in the nation in COVID testing to roughly first, depending on how you count it. To get supplies, the task force had overcome all the logistical obstacles that Joe DeRisi and the BioHub had faced on a massive scale. 10 million nasal swabs, for example. California enjoyed some advantages. A wealth of private testing labs. Maybe the world's finest public university system. A nimble private sector willing to leap into a crisis and help out. A population that agreed that testing was important. Still, no matter how you looked at it, the task force was a triumph. I don't think we repelled aliens who were trying to invade Earth, but it kind of felt like it, said Markovich. Governor Newsom used it as an example of his administration's success. The governors of Illinois and Washington asked Paul Markovich and Charity Dean to brief their cabinets. The White House and assorted federal agencies called and asked them to explain how they had done what they had done. At the end of one call, a staffer in Senator Dianne Feinstein's office had said, "I don't think I've ever been more proud to be a Californian." Their effort was worthy of a case study on project management, but its details are less important here than its success. For even in success, Markovich witnessed the dysfunction of American government. The state's archaic computer systems were clearly unprepared to handle the large amounts of data the new testing would generate. Markovich had offered to replace them for free. He could never figure out why they hadn't taken him up on it. A COVID testing data processing screw-up in August would be the official reason given for Sonia Angel's resignation. The state's crusty procurement system wasn't set up to pay for supplies on short notice. Markovich put the Blue Shield credit card down to secure the nasal swabs, and the state's personnel management was bizarre. "There was something seriously awry," Markovich said. "Everyone I called about Charity tells me she walks on water, and it was pretty clear that she was running the show, but like, wait a minute. She's the assistant health officer? She's not the head health officer? "Where's the head?" He asked around and learned that the head health officer was a woman named Sonia Angel, but he never met her. "It started to be impossible to miss," said Markovich. "This is the biggest public health crisis ever, and she's nowhere to be found." As he walked out the door to return to running his health insurance company, Markovich asked Charity what he thought an obvious question. "I asked her, 'What are you going to do when they ask you to take Sonia's job?'" "They can be crazy stupid, but they can't be crazy stupid forever." And she said, "I'd need to think about that." What she didn't tell him was that she'd already thought about it and was pretty sure what she'd say and why. Back when she was 24 and newly divorced, Charity had rented a small apartment. The place was on the ground floor of a building in a dicey New Orleans neighborhood that got away with describing its units as luxury, only because they were new. For the first time, she had her own porch. It was protected by an iron fence, but visible to anyone who walked by. She felt a need to make it not just presentable, but charming. "I was trying to be my mother," said Charity. "I wanted to show I could be a homemaker." She bought wind chimes and flower pots and flower boxes and dirt and fertilizer and some huge number of brightly colored flowers and turned her front porch into the Luxembourg Gardens. The young professionals and graduate students who lived in the building and passed her porch on the way to their units showered her with compliments. Neighbors came over just to sit on her porch. Even strangers on the street paid her compliments. For a short stretch, Charity Dean was the young woman with the porch bursting with flowers. Then her flowers began to die, though not all at once. The first few deaths left only a bald spot in one of the pots. Charity happened to have a bouquet of plastic flowers. "That's how it started," she recalled, "just to fill in the blank spot in the pot where the flowers had died." From a distance, the fake flowers could pass for real. The comb-over was a success. Then more real flowers keeled over. Charity was studying for 2 graduate degrees at once, and actually didn't have any interest in or aptitude for gardening. She'd imagined that all these flowers needed was to be watered a bit. Now, suddenly, she was facing the specter of her wind chimes swaying over a Sahara of botanical death. "I finally drove down to Michael's Arts and Crafts and bought a pile of fake flowers," she recalled. "But when I picked them out, I was asking a new question. Which of these flowers look the most real?" It wasn't easy to make even the most persuasive fake flowers seem real. She had to keep neighbors from getting too close and invent excuses for keeping them off her porch. Instead of gardening, she had to pretend to garden, which was even more difficult. She felt like an idiot waving to strangers while watering plastic flowers, but for months, she went right on doing it. "It felt icky," she said. "I just got sucked into it." Every now and then, the green shoots of live plants popped up beneath the plastic flowers, then died for lack of sunlight. The metaphor was not lost on her. She knew that her fraud was bound to be exposed, but she kept doubling down on it anyway. Finally, one afternoon, the nice guy who lived down the hall walked into her place and, before she could stop him, walked out on the porch and reached for a flower. His hand recoiled when he realized they were fake. The pandemic response reminded her of that moment, but on a vast scale. The American institutions built to manage risk and respond to a virus had been engaged in a weird simulation of crisis response that did not involve actually trying to stop the virus. The greatest trick the CDC ever pulled was convincing the world containment wasn't possible, she said. Our dignity was lost in not even trying to contain it. She wondered if perhaps they had undergone a process similar to her own, a descent which ended with them devoting lots of energy to appearing to know what to do when they did not. In the beginning, it's filling in gaps, said Charity. You let the falsehood continue until slowly the falsehood takes over. By the time you're done, you are no longer just filling blank spots. You have this burden of maintaining optics. It's all optics. Even as she helped the team of software guys and former Obama officials build the model that persuaded Newsom to shut down the state, Charity had decided that she was leaving. As children, she and her older sister had a phrase to describe the unsettling sensation of fresh doubt about some situation or some person. Black smoke. The black smoke had rolled into state government with the virus and never left. In late March, she'd informed Mark Galley of her plans to resign. He'd asked her to wait and had kept her busy for 6 weeks fixing California's COVID testing. He then asked her, along with two other women in California's Department of Public Health, to run the pandemic response. There was a catch, however. They'd need to allow Angel to remain the public face of the response. That is, to maintain the illusion that the head of the department, as yet not confirmed by the state Senate, actually was in charge. You can't fire the state health officer in the middle of a pandemic, one high-level state official explained to Charity. Another thought that Galley was simply trying to avoid personal embarrassment. He'd hired Angel in the first place. A third suspected that the real worry was Angel's upcoming Senate confirmation hearings being used to embarrass the governor. Whatever the reason, the people who ran the state were twisting themselves into knots to preserve the illusion that all was well inside California's Department of Public Health. For Charity to run the state's pandemic response required the state to formally acknowledge her leadership. She'd need to be given the legal authority that resided with the chief health officer and the chief health officer alone. That clearly wasn't going to happen anytime soon. She'd had to make a pest of herself just to join a Zoom call with the Chan Zuckerberg biohub. Galley made it really clear to me that this was his turf. He said, "You can attend. Don't be on video. Keep yourself on mute and don't say anything." Then again, he'd also told her to stay away from the press conference at which Newsom announced his new testing task force, when she was the testing task force. Her role, it seemed, was to do stuff the state's chief health officer was meant to do while not being seen doing it, as that might raise questions about why the chief health officer wasn't. She couldn't just do the job. She needed to be part of an optics machine. The meeting with the biohub was meant to start at 1:30 in the afternoon on April 29th. Shortly after 1:30, Charity unmuted herself and turned on her video and tried to stall by making small talk with Priscilla Chan about their children. At length, Priscilla said, maybe we should just get started. Joe DeRisi was in his own box. He had one of those faces that would always look younger than it was, Charity thought. His white blonde hair was out of control, even by pandemic standards. He reminded her of Doc in Back to the Future. But then he started to explain what he and his team could do for the state of California, if only the state would let them. "There were no pleasantries," said Charity. "It was diving right in." She felt a sensation she had not felt since she was back in Santa Barbara County, gaining control of some disease outbreak. You know when you pass someone on the street and their cologne or their perfume remind you of someone you love? It was like that. It felt to Charity like a second chance to respond to the virus and to function as a health officer. She'd witnessed the power of genetic analysis when she worked as Santa Barbara's health officer. The links between the five people infected with the hepatitis C virus inside Dr. Tomaszewski's clinic had been made with their genomes. A single mutation in Mycobacterium tuberculosis had allowed her to track Agustin Zeferino. But in both cases, the genomic sequencing had been slow and laborious and expensive. She hadn't realized how much cheaper and faster it had become. So cheap and fast that it might be used on huge populations to reveal how a virus moved within them in real time. Across the state, her former colleagues, the beleaguered local health officers, were trying to control a virus of which they were catching only the briefest glimpses in random black and white photographs. The biohub could hand them a movie. The new weapon could do for the state, indeed for the entire country, what it had done in the mission. It could empower local public health officers who could use the genetic connections between viruses to reveal the risky social relationships between people. If a virus mutated into something different or worse, all the health officers could know at once and adapt. The new web of information could create a thing that the country badly needed, a true network. Where once they had been a bunch of poorly connected dots on the map, there would grow a tight web, a system. "It's the future of disease control," said Charity. The next week, she had on her schedule a rare chance to speak with Governor Newsom when she updated him on the progress of the testing task force. Others were in the room, and she was meant to keep it brief and stick to her assigned subject. But at the end of it, as he was rising to leave, she took a risk. "Can I just tell you about one more thing?" she asked. Newsom sat back down and learned about genomic sequencing. At the end of the lesson, he turned to Nick Shapiro, an outside consultant he'd brought in to advise him on crisis communication, and said, "We're going to do this. You two sit down together and figure it out." Charity spent the next 2 hours at a whiteboard explaining to Shapiro how it all might work, how samples of the virus from all those in California who tested positive could flow to the biohub, and the biohub, free of charge, would perform the analysis, provide it to the local health officers, and train them to use it. In the middle of her explanation, Shapiro had blurted out, "This is fucking awesome!" Here was a chance for the state to lead the country's, and maybe the world's, response to the virus. Here was the chance for the governor to say something that sounded at least vaguely hopeful. Shapiro became so excited that he said, "We're going to announce this tomorrow." They hadn't. "It went into the bureaucracy and never came out," said a person close to the process. "I never really understood why." Someone raised the objection that the biohub had Mark Zuckerberg's name on it and that it might look bad, sort of like the state was handing out people's medical information to Facebook. Though that's not what the state would be doing. Someone else worried about the difficulty of routing the positives from various labs to the biohub. Quest Diagnostics was just then processing, slowly, more of the state's tests than any other lab. You might have thought, as Charity thought, that the testing company would be looking for ways to please a customer it was making hundreds of millions of dollars from. She called the Quest people she'd gotten to know while running the testing task force and asked them to send the specimens from all of California's positive COVID tests to the biohub. "We'd need to charge you $5 a sample if we did that," the Quest people replied. "But we can't, because we agreed to send them to the CDC. Charity knew, because Joe DeRisi had told her, that the CDC had done little to no genomic analysis for any purpose other than the publication of academic papers. We reached out multiple times, offering to conduct sequences for them early on, and they never took us up on it, recalled Patrick Iescu, who worked on sequencing in the biohub. It was never anything concrete, just in the spirit of, thanks, we'll consider it. She also knew that it had turned itself into a black box. It sucked in data from others and seldom shared its own, except in the form of academic papers that brought glory to its authors. At this point, she had a long list of the ways the CDC, with the help of their former employee and her current boss, had made it more difficult for her to do her job. Now they were trying to add to it by interfering with the best chance California had to track the virus and limit its damage. Before she could call the CDC to complain, they called her. They contacted me directly, trying to be friendly, but actually wanting to scare me away from routing their specimens to Joe, she recalled. By the end, I was almost screaming, "You just want specimens for research. I want them for actual frontline investigations." The people who ran the state declined to intervene. They didn't want to get into a spat with the big commercial testing labs or the CDC. Joe sensed that he'd found in Charity a person capable of putting him to proper use, but unable to for some reason. "She was somehow forbidden from answering my questions," he said, "and these were matters of life and death." He and the biohub waited and waited some more, and finally more or less gave up on the state. There was something deeply dysfunctional about how the government worked that I never fully grasped, Joe would later say. "There's no one driving the bus." And the CDC, well, the CDC was its own mystery. "God knows what the hell is wrong with them," said Joe. Charity, like Joe, would later say that their interaction was the last time she felt a flicker of hope that the virus might get anything like the response it required. In late March 2020, when she first announced her intention to resign, she'd made a note in her journal. 1 million excess deaths by May 31st, 2021. It was a prediction. The number of Americans who would die either directly from COVID or indirectly because of, say, lack of access to an overwhelmed healthcare system. Nothing had happened to change her view by the time she finally submitted her resignation in June. Walking out the door, she carried with her a list of unanswered questions. Maybe the biggest was, why doesn't the United States have the institutions it needs to save itself? On September 23, 2020, a former director of the CDC, Bill Foege, sat down to write a letter to the current director, Robert Redfield. Foege was 84 years old and a legend in disease control. To many, the man who eradicated smallpox. He wore his principles lightly, but he had some and had lived by them. He'd been the last CDC director to rise from within the ranks, propelled by the admiration of fellow experts, rather than through connections to a politician. Later, Jimmy Carter would introduce him as the man he'd handpicked to run the agency, but Jimmy Carter hadn't picked him at all. Foege's peers in disease control had. "Dear Bob," he now wrote, as a disease swept through the American population, "I start each day thinking about the terrible burden you bear. I don't know what I would actually do if in your position, but I do know what I wish I would do. The first thing would be to face the truth. You and I both know that, one, despite the White House spin attempts, this will go down as a colossal failure of the public health system of this country. The biggest challenge in a century, and we let the country down. The public health texts of the future will use this as a lesson on how not to handle an infectious disease pandemic." Points 2 and 3 followed point 1. The gist of all three was that the CDC under Robert Redfield had been disgraced. It had let itself be used by the Trump administration to lead the United States in a direction opposite to the direction the United States had once led the world. It was our ability to refocus India from herd immunity to attacking the virus that allowed smallpox eradication to succeed. But Feige wasn't writing to rehash the details. The lies about the severity of the disease posted on the CDC's website, the public guidance that ignored the science, the cowardly silence. He was writing to urge Redfield to reassert the CDC's independence. You could upfront acknowledge the tragedy of responding poorly, he wrote. Apologize for what has happened and your role in acquiescing. Set a course for how CDC would now lead the country if there was no political interference. Give them the ability to report such interference to a neutral ombudsman and assure them that you will defend their attempts to save this country. Don't shy away from the fact that this has been an unacceptable toll on our country. It is a slaughter and not just a political dispute. The White House will, of course, respond with fury. But you will have right on your side. Like Martin Luther, you can say, here I stand, I cannot do otherwise. It was the voice of God, or at least of a different age. That Bill Feige clearly intended for his words to remain private made their effect only more devastating after someone in Redfield's office leaked them to a reporter. But the letter hadn't gone as far as it might have. It framed the problems inside the CDC as a simple matter of a good agency overrun by a bad president. Feige knew that the story was more complicated than that, as he had lived through more of it than anyone else. The problems inside the CDC had reached some kind of climax with Donald Trump, but they hadn't started with Trump. They'd started with a series of unfortunate events in and around the CDC that had ended with Bill Feige running the place. There were reasons for what had happened in this particular flowerbed. That story began in 1976. In March of that year, at the end of the flu season, a handful of soldiers at Fort Dix in New Jersey became ill. One died. The CDC gathered samples and found they'd been infected by a new strain of swine flu that appeared to be related to the virus that had caused the 1918 pandemic. The Army found that at least 500 more soldiers had been infected. There was much that the flu experts did not know, and knew that they did not know, but they were not clueless. They'd detected a pattern. Roughly every decade, the flu genome found some new way to evade the human immune system. They had predicted the previous genetic shift in the virus back in 1968 and were expecting the next one soon and believed that it would involve pigs. The sample size was small, 1918, 1957, 1968. But each time a new strain of flu had been identified, it had resulted in a pandemic. The severity of the disease was an open question. But it felt to the experts a lot like the one back in 1918, when the first outbreaks had also been mild. The head of the CDC, David Sensor, convened a meeting of relevant experts in public health and influenza. Bill Feige was included in the meeting. All the people in the room knew the facts of the case and also that they were on a clock, as the swine flu was likely to return in the autumn. While its severity was anyone's guess, everyone agreed that the new flu, if it returned, would be all over the country in a matter of weeks. They also understood that to vaccinate 217 million Americans would take months, and you had to add to that the 2 weeks it took for a body to achieve immunity after vaccination. Finally, they knew that the United States was the only country with the capacity to manufacture enough vaccine to inoculate its citizens before the fall. Public health people in other countries could take a wait-and-see attitude to this new swine flu because they had no other attitude available. the United States alone had the power to act. Everyone in the room agreed that a vaccine should be produced as fast as possible. The only disagreement was where to store it, in refrigerators or in people's bodies. Was it smarter to stockpile vaccine or antibodies? A small minority, composed of academics with little on-the-ground experience of disease control, suggested it might be better to put the vaccine in the fridge and wait. The most credible among them would later admit that he wasn't sure that he had actually voiced his views, only that he'd asked a few questions. The majority, including the greatest disease battlefield commanders on the planet, felt that the country should vaccinate as many people as possible before the flu season arrived. Flu was more like COVID than like smallpox or polio. It was genetically less stable. The decisions made about it were always going to be tricky. You were always going to be tempted to wait until you were certain of the threat. But to wait was to expose huge numbers of people to the virus before they could be vaccinated. This is one of those situations where there is a strong argument on one side and almost no argument on the other, recalled Bill Foege. Censor heard everyone out and then adjourned the meeting without putting the matter to a vote. There was a clear consensus, albeit with a dissenter or two, that the best thing to do was to vaccinate as many Americans as possible before the flu season arrived. Censor knew that a mass vaccination program would be costly and controversial. You didn't stick needles into 217 million arms without something going wrong. He also knew that there was no way to eliminate the unpleasantness of the decision. The situation was inherently uncertain. As for the matter of why he did not ask for a vote, recalled Bill Foege, he said, "This is going to be political, and if it goes wrong, I'm going to need to take the blame." Holding a vote would have implicated others in the decision and damaged their reputations along with his own. After hearing Censor's reasoning, Foege had a brief chat with himself. "I said to myself, this is a person of courage and integrity." Censor wrote a memo laying out the options but making it clear that the experts at the CDC thought the only responsible course of action was to vaccinate all Americans. He sent it to Dr. Theodore Cooper, an assistant secretary at what was then called the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, HEW. Cooper was actually a bit wary of Censor and the CDC, as their location and reputation left them with an unusual independence. But the memo resonated with him. He remembered stories about the 1918 pandemic his father had told him, of the army rolling into their town of Hershey, Pennsylvania, to dig mass graves. He thought that the country needed to work harder at disease prevention. Censor's memo became Cooper's memo and was then sent to his secretary and, eventually, to the president. Then, just about everything that could go wrong went wrong. The vaccination program began on October 1, 1976, continued for 2.5 months, and reached 43 million Americans. The goal had been to vaccinate everyone, and Censor had known how complicated that would be, which is why he acted with such urgency. But in the event, there was a shocking unevenness across the country in how the vaccine got distributed, because there was no real public health system to do it. Rather, there were thousands of disconnected local public health officers. Where those local public health officers were capable, people were vaccinated. Where the health officer was inept, people weren't. 2 weeks into the program, three elderly people in Pittsburgh died. They'd all been vaccinated at the same clinic. Their deaths made national television news. The vaccine fell under new suspicion, even after heart failure emerged as the cause of all three deaths. A month later, A recently vaccinated man in Minnesota was diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome. Over the next few weeks, more cases emerged until the CDC had counted 54 in 10 states. The vaccine was pretty clearly responsible. That made national news again, as did cases of people who'd been vaccinated and become ill for reasons having nothing to do with the vaccine. The vaccine program went from controversial to unpopular to, on December 16th, suspended. And the pandemic never came. The new strain of swine flu simply vanished. No one knew why. On January 20th, 1977, the Ford administration gave way to the Carter administration. 2 weeks later, the new Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Joe Califano, instructed one of his deputies to call Censor and tell him that he was fired. Hundreds of the CDC's employees signed a petition to protest the move, but Censor himself, who might have put up a fight, stepped aside. The feeling in the air was that Censor's memo had backed President Ford into a corner and made it impossible for him to do anything but vaccinate everyone. The CDC simply had too much authority for the president to ignore what it said. As a television reporter put it at the time, CDC was almost the last federal agency widely regarded by reporters and producers as a good thing, responsible, respectable, scientific, above suspicion. This gave Censor terrific clout. The presidency after Watergate, the military after Vietnam, physicists, universities, to say nothing of HEW or Congress for God's sake. None of them remotely in the same league. Even a hint that any one of them was blocking Censor's urgent memo would have been a big story. Human interest. Good guys, the best against bad. That quote appeared in a book called The Swine Flu Affair by a Harvard professor named Richard Neustadt and a graduate student of his, Harvey Feinberg. It had been commissioned by Joe Califano for his private consumption. Even though he had already drawn his conclusions and fired the CDC director, Califano said he wanted to know what had gone wrong. The short book was very well done. Calling it a report made it sound objective and almost scientific when it was really just journalism. From their interviews, the authors wove a compelling narrative and delivered it in a tone of lordly omniscience. The story had one clear villain, David Censor. The villain had one accomplice, Dr. Theodore Cooper. But his role was less central, like a getaway driver's. Censor, for his part, came off as, at best, sneaky and at worst, wildly manipulative. Censor was not president. Yet as he did his work, this may have been a distinction without a difference. For he evidently thought it was his task to make his constitutional superiors do right, no matter what they thought. And so he did. He also made them do it with but little time to think. Perhaps he'd become intoxicated by his own authority. Perhaps, the authors suggested, Censor was a hero in his own mind. The book never satisfyingly answered the question of motive. Why exactly would a man who had devoted his life to public health mislead the public about a health threat? But if Joe Califano felt any need to justify how he'd fired Censor, the first time a CDC director had been dismissed by a political superior, the book slaked it. His immediate reaction to what had been written as a private document was to make it public. "We intended it just for Califano," recalled Harvey Feinberg. "After taking one look at it," he said, "I have to publish this." The book's publication amplified David Censor's humiliation and put anyone in public health who might stick out his neck to make a decision on notice. It became close to the final word on the episode, at least for people on the outside looking in. Those on the inside had their own, different understanding. Not long after he had replaced Censor, Bill Fagay was asked by Senator Edward Kennedy during a congressional hearing what he would have done had he been faced with the decision that Censor made. "I don't know," Fagay had said. "I hope I would have the courage to have made the same decision he did." D.A. Henderson, who had given Richard Hatchett and Carter Mesher such trouble on the idea of social interventions, also rose to the occasion. Henderson was just then the only human being walking the planet who might challenge Fagay for the title of Greatest Living Disease Battlefield Commander. And Henderson didn't work for the CDC. He ran the Infectious Disease Unit at the World Health Organization in Switzerland. "It is not customary for me to write to authors in regard to their books and my reactions to them," he began in a private letter to Neustadt. "But, in this case, my anticipations of a scholarly work intelligently shedding light on a complex decision-making process were so rudely shattered that I could not resist writing to you to express a personal, bitter disappointment." "The source of the book's many problems," wrote Henderson, "was Richard Neustadt's ignorance of the basic scientific issues relating to influenza epidemiology, virology, vaccine production, etc. That failing was compounded by the clarity with which retrospective judgment is rendered." Unlike David Censor, but like every person interviewed for the book, the authors had the benefit of knowing that there hadn't been a pandemic, and that everything the U.S. government had done to save lives had been a waste of time, money, and the health of some of those vaccinated. After the pandemic failed to happen, everyone agreed that it was always a lot less likely than it had seemed back when things were uncertain. 2 weeks later, Neustadt replied. He was saddened by Henderson's letter, he said. He predicted doom, unless persons of your distinction as public health professionals can be induced to come to grips with the hard issues posed by governmental action through a federal system in a television age, especially after Watergate. Changes in the media and in society had led to changes in the way technical decisions were perceived, and so people with mere technical expertise could no longer make decisions without paying more attention to how they might be made to appear to a cynical public after the fact. Henderson might have left it at that, but for some reason, he couldn't. A month later, he wrote a scathing 3-page, single-spaced reply. It bothered him that this professor held himself out as a student of battlefield decisions without understanding their most important quality, uncertainty. "I have found that there is an order of magnitude difference between bearing the ultimate responsibility for decision-making and being either an advisor or student of the process," he wrote. "It's one thing to experience an orgasm or an arrow between your ribs, and it's another thing to read about it." Censor had experienced an arrow between his ribs. Neustadt had only read about orgasms, and yet used his vicarious experience to swan about as an authority on the subject. As an administrator, one is regularly obliged to make decisions based on incomplete evidence. Henderson concluded, "It was a no-win situation in more ways than you have described. From my many conversations with Censor and the CDC staff during this time, this was only too well appreciated. Thus, your portrayal of them as arrogant, arbitrary, single-minded, and determined to do good to prevent disease with a public and president-be-damned approach is incredibly wide of the mark." And he was right. The swine flu affair, as persuasive as it was, never really faced up to the problem as Censor faced it. If Censor had waited until he knew for sure that a deadly new pathogen was circulating, he'd likely have missed the chance to save hundreds of thousands of lives. Deciding on a swine flu program is like placing a bet without knowing the odds, the authors concluded, without acknowledging that not deciding on a swine flu program was also placing a bet, also without knowing the odds. The odds were never knowable. The authors never considered the interesting counterfactual. Given the uncertainty inherent in the situation, how would censors' decision have been viewed if the pandemic had occurred? How would American politics and the American public have then treated David Censor? The public would have seen that theirs was the only country on earth that not only had grasped the threat to its citizens, but acted to protect them. Bill Foege thought Censor would have been seen as a hero. Foege had followed Censor as the CDC's director, even though he hadn't especially wanted the job. He preferred working in the field, fighting disease. And the job was clearly changing in ways that made Foege want it even less. The White House meddled more and more, he recalled. The CDC director was then a career civil servant, and when Jimmy Carter was replaced by Ronald Reagan, Foege remained in his job. But now, when Foege testified before Congress, the White House sent minders to sit with him and monitor what he said. They meddled in science that conflicted with the interests of Reagan's base and his financial backers. Any research having to do with AIDS, for instance, had to first be vetted by the White House. The breaking point for Foege came in 1983. After the CDC's researchers established a connection between aspirin and Reye's syndrome in children. When given to children suffering from flu or measles, aspirin could trigger swelling in the liver and the brain, and in rare cases, death. Companies that manufactured aspirin petitioned the White House. "The White House called and told us to cease and desist," recalled Foege. "Do a new study." The aspirin makers had been able to force the CDC to scrap its findings and slow down science. Foege had resigned after that. "The fact that they would risk the lives of children, it just bothered me so much," he said. He later regretted his decision and wished that instead he had forced them to fire him, as it would have made more of a stink. The Reagan administration must have noticed the possibility. After Foege resigned, the White House converted the position of CDC director from career civil servant to presidential appointee. Since the agency's inception back in 1946, no one had paid much attention to the party politics of the CDC director. "No one ever asked me," said Foege. Henceforth, the CDC director would not bubble up from inside the CDC, lifted by the approval of his peers, but would be plucked from the supporters of whichever politician happened to occupy the White House. Foege's replacement, James O. Mason, was an ideological soulmate and good friend of Republican Senator Orrin Hatch. If somehow he still managed to displease the White House, the president could fire him on a whim, as he could not have fired David Censor. The relationships that Robert Redfield and Tony Fauci enjoyed with Donald Trump give you an idea of the difference between a career civil servant and a presidential appointee. If Donald Trump had gotten up and said, "Fauci, you're fired," nothing would have happened, which is likely why he never did it. The person with the authority to fire Tony Fauci was Francis Collins, the head of the National Institutes of Health. To do it, however, he would have needed to show cause, which is why Fauci was always less likely to be fired than to be reassigned to, say, the Indian Health Service. Even then, Fauci could have appealed the decision to something called the Merit Systems Protection Board. The Merit Systems Protection Board would not have been able to process his complaint, as it lacked a quorum. Trump never staffed it. But you get the idea. To fire a competent civil servant is a pain in the ass. To fire a competent presidential appointee is as easy as tweeting. Henceforth, the CDC director would not serve across administrations as past directors had done, but would be replaced when the president was replaced, or usually sooner. The entire United States government had been drifting that way for some time. Management jobs once done by career civil servants being turned into roles performed by people appointed by the president. One of the problems this created was management inexperience. The average tenure of the appointees fluctuated between 18 months and 2 years, depending on the administration. Another was the kind of person the job now selected for. There would be exceptions, of course, but the odds favored the pleaser. The person who did not present risks to the White House's political operation. The person who deferred rather than made hard decisions. A Chamberlain rather than a Churchill. When she'd come across David Sensor's story, Charity saw in him both inspiration and explanation. She was born the year Sensor was fired, so in that way, he felt like ancient history. But the shift inside the CDC that had begun with the swine flu affair had led it to become a different sort of place. "Now I understood why the CDC was so admired," said Charity. "It was because of people like him." But Sensor had also exposed the price of bravery. After Sensor, or after Fege, the CDC's relationship to disease control had changed in ways that eliminated its need for bravery. It had begun a descent. It had replaced the flowers on its porch with fake ones and hoped no one would notice. But people did notice, at least those who came close to the porch. Rajiv Venkaya had seen things that caused him to exclude the CDC from playing a role in the invention of pandemic planning. Joe DeRisi had seen how little interest they paid to a weapon that might transform the control of disease. And the need to make hard decisions in public health didn't just go away. It got pushed down in the system onto local health officers. They had little social status and were thus highly vulnerable. But they also had little choice if they hoped to save lives. Local health officers across the country paid with their jobs and more in their attempts to control a disease without the help of the Centers for Disease Control. Sarah Cody, the health officer in Santa Clara County, had issued the country's first stay-at-home order after finding the country's first domestic transmission of COVID. And now Sarah Cody needed round-the-clock police protection. Nicole Quick, the health officer in Orange County, seeing the virus rampaging through her community, had issued a mask order only to have the CDC waffle about the need for masks. She'd been run out of her job and finally, for fear for her safety, the state. Before he was fired, David Sensor had run the CDC for more than a decade and might have imagined running it a decade more. The event flipped a switch inside him. He went from drinking socially to drinking too much to being treated for alcoholism. For a decade, he'd served as a sort of mayor to the public health village in Atlanta, but he no longer felt comfortable there. He took a job in New Jersey with a company that made medical devices but hated it. His heart wasn't in business. He applied and was hired for the job of New York City Health Commissioner. The New York Times uncovered the fact that he'd been treated for alcoholism and ran an article about his failure to disclose it. "I've got a disease and I'm treating it," he said in response, but it felt like a second humiliation. His wife would never fully recover from it. Sensor declined so many opportunities to visit Atlanta that it felt to his son, Steve, as if he had exiled himself. When Steve asked him why, he'd say, "You can't go home again." In June of 2009, 2 years before his death, Sincer received an email from someone claiming to work at the White House. It invited him to come to Washington and share what he'd learned about decision-making in a pandemic. The White House wouldn't be able to pay his plane fare, but would welcome his thoughts. Sincer suspected a prank. He couldn't imagine anyone in the White House caring what he thought. Steve Sincer recalls his father forwarding the email to him and asking him what he made of it. The younger Sincer inspected it right down to the name on the bottom, Richard Hatchett. "Dad, it looks legit," he said. Yet, whatever had happened inside of Sincer had scarred him so deeply that even as he stood outside the White House, he did not entirely believe that he had been invited to visit. Richard and Carter had both read The Swine Flu Affair back when they came together in the Obama White House. Neither was particularly struck by what today strikes a lay reader: the total absence of any strategy to fight a virus apart from the vaccination. At no point in the entire saga did anyone raise the idea of social intervention of any kind. There was no talk of closing schools or masks or social distancing. That's how deep the accepted wisdom had run. Apart from vaccinating the population, everyone agreed there was little to be done. Richard and Carter had helped to change that view. They sort of took it for granted that a kind of disease fatalism had once been common. What stuck with them both was how naturally the society had turned on David Sincer, and how easily they might find themselves in the same position. Together with a few others, Richard and Carter had come up with the idea of asking the surviving characters from The Swine Flu Affair back to the White House to talk about what they'd learned. Richard thought there was a value in history, and, maybe more to the point, he could see that the president he served shared the view. Government, and the value government provides, isn't just the whim of whoever happens to be elected at the moment, said Richard. That government provides continuity across administrations and should be the repository of accumulated institutional experience and wisdom. His White House bosses agreed and told him to plan the meeting. But the moment he had to explain the thing in his own words, Richard realized that he had a problem. In drafting the memo, I faced a real challenge coming up with a rationale for the meeting. Getting current senior officials together with 7 officials from the Ford administration sounded like a good idea, but what could they actually talk about? I couldn't imagine the invited senior officials from 76, most quite advanced in age, relishing the prospect of coming to talk about how they had assembled perhaps the greatest public health fiasco of the last half century. Hatchett's letter to his son, June 29, 2009. The meeting, held in the Roosevelt Room, might have turned into a non-event. The Ford administration was never going to tell the Obama administration anything big that it did not already know. The television age had long since given way to the cable news age, which had given way to the age in which every American citizen was a broadcaster. The Obama people knew how quickly and easily mobs formed. They knew how decisions could be made to seem. They could really only nod politely at the biggest point made by David Sincer and the others. To preserve the president's credibility, you needed to keep him as loosely linked to the public side of the decision-making as possible. The enemy was a virus. The enemy's chief weapon was rapid and random mutation. It might well necessitate big changes of strategy, and these were bound to be viewed by the public as signs of ineptitude, and the president would need to seem to be the one to rescue these situations rather than be rescued from them. President Obama himself took an interest in the meeting, however, and insisted on sitting in. He'd wanted to hear what history had to say. The passage of time allowed for him and everyone else to see that the blame that had been assigned to an individual was more fairly bestowed on a situation. And David Sensor came away with the feeling of having been understood. "It was a beautiful, beautiful thing for our family," said Steve Sensor. "It's in the White House, and someone is actually recognizing what happened." "Not been a good day," Carter Mesher wrote on November 23rd, 2020. "My dad started having cold symptoms a couple of days ago and had a fever today. There is only one cold going around these days. He was back in the ER and tested positive for COVID." The pandemic he'd done so much to prepare the country for had finally come. If Carter had been given a million years, he'd never have imagined it as it happened. He'd always kind of assumed that the strategies that he and Richard had cooked up would be used in a smart and targeted way. They'd reduce illness and death so effectively that people might wonder why the government had bothered to intervene at all. "Richard and I used to talk about this all the time," recalled Carter. "What if we do all these things and we close the schools and the result is that we had a very mild epidemic? And people look around and say, why did we do all this?" They decided that their hides would be saved by the countries that had bungled their pandemic response. They'd be able to point to them and say, look, that's what would have happened to us. They never imagined that other countries would use the United States to demonstrate their own counterfactual. "We are the bad example for the rest of the world," said Carter. "That's what is so embarrassing." What puzzled Carter, maybe more than anything, was how people who should have known better had downplayed the risk. Donald Trump was one thing. Scientists were another. Carter couldn't get over that an actual medical professor at Stanford named John Ioannidis became a sensation on U.S. cable news in the spring of 2020 by claiming the virus posed no real threat. Ioannidis predicted that no more than 10,000 Americans would die. He condemned social distancing policies as a hysterical overreaction. That was all that those who wished to deny the reality needed to be able to say. "Look, we have experts too." To say, "See, all the experts are fake." Carter had received threats in the mail from such people who had learned of his role in the strategy. Carter's father was the first to be diagnosed. The next day, his mother became ill with the virus and followed his father to the hospital. Carter arranged for his father to return home with a supply of oxygen. "If he is going to die, I don't want him to die alone and away from family," he wrote. The doctors put his mother on steroids and started her on antivirals. "All we can do now is wait," said Carter. And his father rallied and told his son that he was going to beat the virus. Then he started to cry, a little because of happiness for beating the virus, but also sadness because my mom was so sick, wrote Carter, then continued. "It is hard to fathom all the pain the virus has brought. The virus is truly a demon from hell. I think deep down inside we all sensed this. It was why we tried to get leaders to take early aggressive action to minimize the pain that we knew would come." 18 days later, Carter's mother died. Carter sat down and wrote a long letter to his family. His theme was gratitude for the lives they had shared, but his words were suffused with other emotions. Over the past several days, I felt like a balloon that lost all its air, he wrote at the end. But I know that with a little time, I will reinflate. He was like the surgeon, famously described by a writer, who had inside himself a small cemetery where he buried his failures and, from time to time, went to pray. And so, he went to pray. Epilogue. The Sin of Omission. It took her longer than it should have to find the grave. Except for the names on the stones, the plots were identical. In every direction stretched the dead, side by side in long rows, like houses in a new development. 8,000 or more precisely drawn rectangles, each marked by the same flat granite headstone, perfectly preserved by the California desert. Delius Oscar Johnson, 1866 to 1959, obviously had been here for some time, but his final resting place still looked brand new. It was indistinguishable from the rectangles freshly carved at the edge of the graveyard for a sale to the future dead. Something was coming, something bigger. Charity Dean did not know if the next pathogen would leap from an animal or a laboratory. She didn't actually know anything. She just sensed it, the way she'd sensed that Mrs. Lorenzen, her second-grade teacher in Junction City, whom she adored, was pregnant before she'd told anyone, and completely panicked the woman by blurting it out in class. "Oh, no, I'm not," her teacher had exclaimed, leaving Charity feeling hurt and confused until, a few days later, a woman pulled her aside and asked, "How did you know?" It had always been a part of the story Charity told herself about herself, that she knew things before she knew why, that she had a nose for things about to change and for risk. A year into the pandemic, she thought of COVID as Mother Nature's gift to the country. The hardest part, to a public health officer trying to control a communicable disease, was that you were always looking in the rearview mirror. COVID had given the country a glimpse of what Charity had always thought might be coming, a pathogen that might move through the population with the help of asymptomatic spreaders, and which had a talent for floating on air. Airborne and asymptomatic. Now that we knew how badly we responded to such a threat, we could begin to prepare for it. "Mother Nature has given us a fighting chance," she said. "She's tipped the odds in our favor." The graveyard was empty. The February sun was setting behind the desert mountains, and a new chill was in the air. She picked up the pace and walked up and down the long rows in search of what she'd come for. Even before she'd quit her job, she'd had that odd thought that the country didn't have the institutions that it needed to survive. In particular, it did not have what it needed to battle a pathogen. The pandemic had given America's enemies a clear view of the country's weakness, its inability to respond to a COVID-like threat. On her calls with the Wolverines, she'd ask, "What does the country need?" She was really asking herself, as no one had the answer. Her conclusion had pained her some. Once she'd become a public health officer, she'd imagined an entire career in public service. Now she did not believe that the American government, at this moment in its history, would ever do what needed doing. Disease prevention was a public good, but the public wasn't going to provide anything like enough of it. From the point of view of American culture, the trouble with disease prevention was that there was no money in it. She needed to find a way to make it pay. The problem was a crazy problem. It wasn't going to have a non-crazy solution. Still, she'd sort of shocked herself. She'd never have the slightest interest in business. But if she wanted to save the country, she'd need to become an entrepreneur and create a company. Though in business, she quickly learned, she couldn't talk like that. When she said she wanted to build a tool to save the country, people just smiled and thought she was goofy in the head. But when she said things like, "I'm going to create a data-based tool for disease prevention that companies can use to secure their supply chains," serious business types nodded. Five smart people have replied with confusion when I said the company was to save the world and protect our country, said Charity, after her first attempts to explain her vague idea. Then when I said, "We're going to do private government operations like Blackwater," their eyes lit up and they said, "Oh, wow, you could take over the world." She'd entered the private sector with the bizarre ambition to use it to create an institution that might be used by the public sector. She'd already hired 20 people, among them public health nurses, and some of the team at the Chan Zuckerberg Biohub, responsible for genomic sequencing, including Josh Batson and David Dinnerman. Joe DeRisi had signed on as an advisor. Carter Mesher was about to. She'd raised millions of dollars in capital. Venrock, a leading healthcare venture capitalist, had taken a stake in the new company. As a local health officer, she hadn't been able to get the tens of thousands of dollars she needed for some new disease-stopping machine. In the private sector, people would throw tens of millions at an idea. If she failed, it wouldn't be because investors wouldn't give her the money to try. The public health company, she'd call it. It was still unclear what the public health company might become. The person with the most curious view of the possible future was Todd Park, the former White House chief technology officer. After he'd seen Charity in action in Sacramento, Park had told her he'd help her with whatever she wanted to do. He'd created three separate billion-dollar healthcare companies himself, and in each case, his idea was to find the person who was the very best in the world at a given task and, effectively, turn them into software. For example, in 2004, he'd found a woman named Sue Henderson, who, for reasons no one could understand, was the single best person in the country at getting insurance companies to pay doctors' bills. The country had hundreds of health insurance companies, each with its own rules, which they'd change capriciously. Sue Henderson somehow knew them all, along with the language that got them to pay a bill. Todd's brother, Ed, had sat in a room with her and coded her reaction to various situations. It had taken them 5 years to finish the job. By the time they were done, the company, Athena Health, had become the country's leading medical biller because thousands of doctors used Sue Henderson to deal with insurance companies. Todd Park thought that the public health company might do the same kind of thing by turning Charity into the local public health officer for everyone who needed one, a group that suddenly included just about every big corporation. At length, Charity found the grave she'd come for. Gerald Scott Jones, May 23, 1958 to December 8, 2015. He'd been found dead on a Santa Barbara street corner at the age of 57. The official cause of death made for a long list, but what its items had in common was neglect. When he died, the United States had just entered a 3-year period which the life expectancy of its citizens had fallen every year. The first such stretch since the First World War and the 1918 pandemic. And so Jerry was, in his way, a representative case. He'd first turned up in the emergency room at Cottage Hospital when Charity was a resident. She'd treated him for years, first in the ER and then on the trauma floor, then in the ICU and, after she'd become the health officer, in the basement at the Santa Barbara County Clinic. She'd finally treated him on a street corner after he refused to visit the room she worked in at the homeless shelter. "Too many drugs there," he'd said. "I don't do drugs. I'm an alcoholic." She'd thought, "Me too." But she'd never said it. She had been too worried about preserving her status, about keeping the flowers seeming real. But she'd loved the guy. She thought of him as maybe the most honest person she'd ever met. "Dr. Dean, I'm not going to stop drinking, so no need to start," he'd say. And that was that. Jerry never knew it, but he'd taught Charity about the disease and where it ended if left untreated. What Charity always regretted most was not what she had said or done, but what she hadn't. Sins of omission. She had left him with a false impression of who she was. It was unlike her not to have told him. She felt she had left something unsaid. So now she said it. Then she made an incision in the ground, buried a piece of herself, and moved on.
We hope you have enjoyed this audio production of The Premonition, A Pandemic Story by Michael Lewis, read